Wow, I was only 4 hours left? That doesn't sound right. Well, we'll go ahead and record and we'll try to figure it out later. Okay. Oh. I'm wondering if this stuff's even any good anymore. It goes bad so easily, corn tortillas. And it's Sunday. It's time to go off. Back to the crash site, ready for another week of excitement. The cool thing is that Lisa and Brenna Jelaine are going to be doing a temple trip with me on Thursday night. So I'm going to pray hard that nothing weird happens Thursday afternoon so I can just leave and go and, you know, take care of what's needed. All right, we're going to have to do this. I can tell already. Let's get everything kind of pulled together. It's going to be where we're supposed to be having another heat wave this week. So, hopefully not too bad. That old, well, anyway, okay. Being kind of careful. There's a lot of people coming in that look a little like they're not going to stop, and holy frijoles, I'm a little concerned. Get on the interstate, get things kind of an even keel, and then I can talk about things. Now I'm stuck behind a truck that just decided that now was the perfect time. They pulled out kind of in front of me, and that's, you know, I can't say much. I've pulled that stunt on a lot of people when I'm coming up on a truck and somebody's kind of coming up kind of fast in the left lane. Now go ahead and get in the left lane anyway. And I know that's kind of upsetting. You know, where that's like, hey, you're in that other lane, you need to just stay in that lane. Stay slow until I pass, and then you can come into the lane and do what you're going to do. Anyway, so all right, we're cruising on the road. Stay on the south route. Stay off the interstate. I'm sure they're still doing work on it. I've had to spend 20 minutes, half an hour, to move half a mile. So I'm much more interested in going off the interstate. Just to feel like I'm still making good momentum. I love going on State Highway 3. Which is a road that kind of goes from the interstate down to Encino. But there's been some traffic problems. I don't know at what point I'm going to decide that I'm going to try that again. It's kind of a fun road. It stays way up high, so it's really kind of cool as in temperature-wise. And that's really pleasant. The road through Vaughan and all that, it's not as a... I just don't enjoy it as much. It's really hazy. These are from all the fires in California. You're going, well, it's a long way away for the smoke to drift, and you go, it is. It's about 1,000 miles. And but we're getting the haze here. Because of how huge the fires are over in California. So, has to go all the way through California and Arizona and through almost the entirety of New Mexico to reach us in Tucumcari. So, that's a heck of a trip. Like I said, about 1,000 miles. Lisa's been doing in-service meetings. And at her new job at San Juan School as an aide. And they've been doing these kind of light personality tests, and they compare you to birds. There's an eagle and an owl and a dove and a parrot. And Lisa figured out that she's somewhere between an owl and a dove. I'm kind of an eagle with some owl to them, and I don't know. Anyway, I used to be kind of into personality tests, and then I started getting the sense that they were a little kind of ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy on a certain level, and so I don't really do them all that much anymore. Anyway, I don't remember what was really talked about. Between Lisa and I about it. We went off and had a celebration meal in Clovis over it. So that was pretty good. thought Lisa's cell phone, I'm not a big fan of cell phones, that it just wasn't charging. Didn't matter what you kind of threw at it, it just wouldn't charge. And finally goofed with it enough that now it's charging again under some circumstances. So, I don't know. That was good. That was one disaster averted. And our, the cabinets in the kitchen are really kind of cheap. Hold up much weight, and one of them fell down. They're just in there with little plastic stays to keep the shelf up. It's a really big shelf, and one of them just snapped off due to the weight on the shelf, and I ended up putting something a lot more substantial in there to hold up that thing. That's pretty good. I got my spare tire back in business, so I'm in pretty good shape that way. So things are going pretty good. Pretty happy. Talking about knowing Christ. And we were sharing insights. I've always striven to kind of come up with a good term to use to describe what I think Christ's manner is. You know, everybody says, "Oh, he's so loving and kind," and you're going, "You know what? I don't mean to be rude, but everything I've ever read about Christ's interaction with people." Didn't really come off as loving. Not to say he isn't loving of us, and that we shouldn't love him. But I finally settled on the term businesslike. Especially in our day, where he's not living on the earth, and he isn't having personal interactions with us particularly. You know, he seems very businesslike. There's things that must be done. And that's the most important thing, is to make sure that you understand what things need to be done. And he's often rather pointed. He isn't mealy-mouthing about it. He's not trying to make you feel better about it. You know. You know, people talk about Christ's love. And he doesn't use that term very often at all. In fact, I'm not sure he used it ever. Other terms were used. I don't know if that's bad translation. I don't know what, but, you know. He is, describes himself, and other people describe him as merciful, kind. That one's good. You know, everybody says, oh, well, that's loving. And you're going, well, then it would have used the word love. I said, sorry. You know, I said, I'm not denigrating anything at all. Christ is a person endowed with, to a large degree, by a sense of mission. And, accomplishing what needed to be done. So I almost, so that's why I almost come back to the old thing of, you know what, maybe a good term for it, his manner, is businesslike. He's here to do what needs to be done. And he's not being sidetracked. I don't know if that... I have never been a goal-oriented person. You know, people can say, well, you're a drifter. And you're going... Guy, that sounds bad. If you want to look at it in a good way, you'd say he's open to opportunities. And, you know, it wouldn't be inaccurate to say that I'm a drifter. My grandmother Nemro, my dad's mother, she was quite concerned about me not having a clear direction I was going in. She was very happy when I had been in New Mexico State for 5 years, I remember calling her. Didn't call her very often at all. But she was very happy because she got the impression that I had found myself, or I'd finally settled down. And I'm sorry to say that I hadn't. Always trying to make sure that Lisa's taken care of, that I'm meeting her needs. And she tells me these days that I did a good job. And you go, good. if I ever had a goal, that was probably the only goal I had. Even though sometimes I would take a pay cut. And Lisa never liked that. That was not part of the plan. Anyway. It's been interesting watching Watcher Palmer on YouTube. Scott Palmer. He was a stake president and a mission president. You know, served on that level in the church. And he was saying the same thing. He said, I've never been a goal-oriented person. I just, you know, I've always felt like if you had a goal in mind, you might miss what the Lord really wants you to be doing. I remember Elder Oaks, who's now in the first presidency, talking about some of the thoughts of what he wanted to do in his life and how it kind of worked out. You don't plan to be an apostle. And he didn't speak against being goal-oriented, but I think he did say, don't be so goal-oriented that the Lord trying to move you to a different path is impossible because you're so focused on some goal. Anyway, I seem kind of disjointed in what I'm talking about today. I'll probably stop recording here soon, probably sooner than I normally would. And, listen to something. Although I'm happy to do these videos. This is good stuff for me personally. I've always made recordings. You know, if you go and look back at my recordings things, there's 15 years of recordings there. And in various circumstances, sometimes while driving, sometimes while walking to work. Whatever circumstances work out. For how I was doing things, whether they were kind of formal and thinking about being a podcast or a series, or just being bored on the road and turning on the recorder and starting talking. Walter Palmer and I have a ton in common, at least insofar as our take on current things going on. A little more accepting of other possible views. Don't always agree, but same sort of guy. To feel good that I'm not going off the deep end. Lisa's so worried about me abandoning the brethren, and I'm going, yeah, I'm hanging with the prophet and the apostles. Preacher Palmer's, Watcher Palmer's a little concerned with CES and trying to always paint pictures with the happy brush. And you're going, most of the scriptures I'm reading are about, you know, if you don't do what I ask, how much trouble you're going to be in, how bad it's going to get, punishments that await. And I've noticed that too as I've been reading. You know, I think I hear plenty of the good side and how marvelous Christ is. This is, I, like I said, you know, people say, we always bring up the other side. I said, only to try to make sure that it's given that the bad side of these things gets at least a little treatment. I said, you know, I don't have to sit there and make a whole lot of lip service to the bright, shiny, happy rainbows and butterflies version of Jesus in his gospel. Says everybody gets that plenty. Said it's important to bring up the fact that if we don't live up to our covenants, if we don't make good on our commitments, if we aren't striving to better ourselves in the Lord's way, so what repentance is, it's getting better. The tough things await. I've never had anybody really confront me about that. I think everybody's really quite concerned about so many people, women, young women especially, soy boys, who, and I mean, after all of the whitewashing, which I feel is going on, you know, to try to make everything look pretty and everything look great. Even after doing all the whitewashing, I said, it ends up being fodder for those who are walking away from the church. And sad to say, to some degree, they have a point. They really have a point. You know, the church is trying to be more forthcoming about some of the greasy underbelly of prophets and apostles and people and the church itself as an organization. It's never been a problem for me because I'm not one of those people that says the church is perfect. So no, church, this is, the church doesn't have to be perfect for me. It's run by people. People change their minds. You know, a big part of leadership is using your own wisdom in addition to the Spirit. And sometimes you just use your own wisdom. And things get altered, you know. People talk to the brethren and they go, oh, well, that's a thought. I don't think we ever really considered that. And it's like, yeah, this is, you know, and everybody thinks that these guys are infallible, you know, that they walk and talk with God on a daily basis. And you go, no. I'm not saying that they don't keep themselves in a state where they can have communion with Christ. But Christ leaves us to our own devices a lot. I think that's why, to a large extent, and it's a two-edged sword probably for, you know, many of our, I'd have to say almost all of our apostles and prophets are accomplished men, either in business or in administration of, you know, universities and stuff like that. Successful men coming from the professions, lots of doctors, lots of lawyers, and sometimes humility can be tough among these men. I don't doubt that a lot of prayer and a lot of struggling with to know the mind and will of the Lord is done to anticipate or to decide who's going to be the next apostle. I don't doubt that in the least. I think that's done. But I also know that this stuff doesn't, you know, names don't flutter down from some height, you know, and they go, oh my gosh, this guy's name is John Smith. Let's go look in all the records and see if we can find John Smith. You know, these are people that the apostles and the prophets already have dealt with, are aware of. Everybody gets upset because it's like, well, these are all Utah, Salt Lake City sorts. There's a few outliers, and there's growing to be more of them. Elder Renlund, I seem to remember him speaking and him trying to help people understand that he wasn't just some Utah born and bred and, you know, University of Utah, BYU, educated, Jell-O Belter. Elder Renlin really worked hard to say that he wasn't that guy. The funny thing was, where was he born? Salt Lake City. You know, and he said he traveled quite a bit. And you're going, okay, you know, I'm not, I understand. The brethren pick from and consider and look through the men that they know. Typically, people from the first quorum of the 70. Don't mean to be weird at all. Elder Bednar was a real outlier. He was an area authority before he became an apostle. Now, he was a little different because he was the president of BYUI. There's only three church university, four church universities. And the presidents of those four church universities, you know, they have dealings with the first presidency all the time. And that's one of the big things is, are you known to the brethren? You know, do they have experience with you? And you're going, well, that just means that you're always going to get Utah types. And you go, probably. You know, and people go, well, Elder Suarez and Elder Gong aren't particularly Salt Lake types. And you go, Elder Gong is. He said, I don't know if he was born in Salt Lake City, but he's lived in Salt Lake City the majority of his life. And of course, you know, once you go into the 70, you know, you move to Salt Lake City. So you become part of that milieu, and it's difficult to you know, you're in there. And you go, well, what about Elder Suarez? He's from Brazil. And you go, yeah, yeah. And you go, but he was a 70 for a while. You know? But, yeah, was he born in Salt Lake City? No. Did he have a Salt Lake City pedigree at all? No. Was his wife from Utah? And you go, I don't think so. And you go, Elder Suarez really ends up being Elder Uchtdorf, of course, who's now one of the senior apostles, and Elder Suarez really are the two of the apostles that don't have a Utah pedigree on some level. You know, you always have these brethren come in and say, yeah, I joined the church when I was 17. And you go, yeah, yeah, that's great. Uh-huh. And then I went to BYU and I married into an old line pioneer family. And you go, yeah, okay. And I don't want to denigrate a soul. Don't want to denigrate a soul. You know, I'm just saying it should not be surprising to anybody. The brethren have to know, have some knowledge of these people, and you don't get that knowledge unless you're around them, unless they've got some background with you. And people go, it's almost incestuous, you know. What was it? Elder Cook was a missionary companion with Elder Holland when they were on their missions, and you're going, well, this is just bizarre. In a church of several million, we're up above 16 million members, you know, now how many of those are active and amazing is anybody's guess, but, you know. And you're going, guy, this sounds kind of incestuous. And you go, there's really not a way to keep that from happening. And you have to understand that Christ, when Christ brought together his apostles, there was some stuff going on there. There were brothers, there were cousins, there was family, you know? people weren't, as I said, they weren't chosen out of the air. Who's this John Smith? Let's go look at all the records for John Smith and let's find this, our next apostle out of that group of people. It just doesn't happen that way. I don't mean to be unfair or rude, but I'm very sure, quite sure, that the Lord rubs these people up against each other. And the way the Lord does, you get a missionary calling together, you know, it's a stake president that you like going to their stake and doing things. I don't think it ends up being campaign. You know, everybody says, well, you know, it is a hierarchy of campaigning. And you go, I don't think so. I don't think so. But it is certainly familiarity and affinity. It really is. Like I say, you know, I said a Relief Society president really should... Oh, this doesn't look good at all. A Relief Society president really should get counselors that they know and like. It's really hard to have a presidency where they're going in different directions or that some of them may not even like each other. Now, you know, I was kind of an outlier that way, and I often chose counselors when I was the president of, like, the Elders Quorum or something. Based on giving people opportunities to grow and to go out and do things together, serving in the church, so we could do things. And that was the way I kind of did it. I would not necessarily get somebody that I liked. But I don't think along those lines. It really, there really isn't a lot of people that I developed strong feelings for, up or down, honestly. And that's both good and bad. I don't really develop friendships readily, and I don't know how that feels for the other person who says, oh, Jason Denver, he's a great friend of mine. And you go, I am? Okay. You know, I've gotten to the point to where I don't use the term acquaintance, even though that's probably a little more honest. I'll say, oh, he's a friend of mine. And, you know, and they can say, oh, well, I don't know him that well. And you go, yeah, we don't, like, hang out together. I've got other fish to fry. Of course, the problem is when those missionaries come and they say, well, we think you should be sharing the gospel with your friends. And you go, you know what? They really aren't friends. He says, I don't really have friends. Even in the church, when they say, are we friends? And you go, well, we've helped each other sometimes, and I'm grateful for that. I says, but that, does that make us friends? No. You know, co-workers is closer to the mark. At church, it's fellow servants. You know, we serve together. And you go, eh, I'm just this fella. And, you know, if I was really wanting to have high office, you know, if I really wanted to do those things, the smart way to do it would be to start schmoozing with certain people. You know, you need to become friends with the stake president, so that when he thinks of your unit and he thinks of who would do a good job in that unit as the stake president, that you would be on that list. you know, and you would do some favors, you know, you would volunteer for service projects and stuff like that, so they can see that you're out there doing it. Some people are just like that, and those will naturally become bishops and high counselors and stake presidents and mission presidents. Some people just have that sort of, you know, just that sort of manner. And it's not to say, well, only certain kind of people can actually get into office in the church. And you go, well, it says, what do you want the brethren or your stake presidency to do? What do you want them to do? They only have a certain they only know a certain number of people. It typically isn't going to rain down from heaven. Now, you know, stake presidents are kind of a weird. Are kind of a weird thing, because most of the time an area authority or a general authority 70, which they will usually send to do these kinds of changes as an actual general authority, they aren't going to know anybody in your stake, probably. It isn't impossible, but they probably don't know anybody in the stake, so they say, I need to go through the current stake presidency, you know, I need to interview the high counselors, the bishops, you know, it usually goes on those kind of lines, and typically, after you've gone to that group, it's usually one of them, you know, and you can be weird about all you want to be, and it's like, well, that's how it comes. Even though the brethren have been quite pointed, I remember when they were talking about patriarchs, and I think some, I don't remember if it was a general authority in conference talk, but it must have been, because I'm not really in any other council except the general one. You know, and they said, you know, we fall into the trap of stake patriarchs being former stake presidents and, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, and that the council was, it's probably going to be somebody that's not one of those people. Although, can I say, most of the time it ends up being those guys. Several men can fill these callings. You know, it isn't like a soulmate. There is one particular man that should be the stake patriarch right now. I'm not saying that can't happen. I've heard the stories where that has happened. But I'm perfectly okay with, the stake patriarch in our stake now. He was in the stake presidency as a counselor. Then he became the stake president. He was a temple president. And I think he's a fine patriarch. And so, you know, it's like, are you going to get weird about it? And you go, no. I think he's wonderful. Did the Lord approve of him? Yeah. I would say the Lord did approve of him. Now, that doesn't mean that there was only going to ever be one choice and, you know, some wonderful grandpa-ish guy of advanced years that never really had ever been put into leadership, even on the local level, might have also been, you know, if the inspiration would have come to interview him, would have been found to be a person that the Spirit said, that's your next patriarch. I'm not saying, you know, and to say it that way, I think, is to imply kind of a one-to-one correspondence, right? This person right here is the one and only patriarch for right now for the Amarillo Stake. And it's like, no, you know. I said, I'm not saying that can't be so. But what I am saying is I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Spirit would have confirmed any number of men as being in a position and being of the spiritual bent to do a good job and to have been a good patriarch. Hear stories about such on occasion, but yeah, is it going to end up being somebody everybody in the stake already knows? The patriarch before that had been a stake presidency counselor in the past, and I think he'd done other things too. He had been a bishop and you know, several other things. And you go, what do you expect? Like I said, what do you expect anybody to do? The people that are going to come to mind are not people they've never heard of very readily at all. It's far more likely that it's going to be somebody that they've known, somebody that they've worked beside, somebody that, you know, somebody that comes to mind. And that's going to be the way it goes. Now, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the brethren made a concerted effort to try to introduce some diversity into the quorum of the 12. That's perfectly fine, and to a large extent, that's exactly what apostles are supposed to be, because apostles are basically missionary, emissary, diplomat sorts to the world. And so it's very, you know, when thinking along those lines, it makes total sense to have those kinds, to consider strongly those sorts of people. And when you're considering those sorts of people, it's not surprising when the Spirit says, let's do that one. You know, so yeah, when people go, Utah, and you're going, what else do you expect them to do? I said, right, is there a random name that's supposed to float down out of the heavens and, you know, kind of like the goblet of fire, the Harry Potter goblet of fire, and spit out, and then you have to go searching around to find that person? You know, oh, Juan Sanchez. How many Juan Sanchez's do we have in the church? And you go, about a couple of thousand. And you go, oh, great. How are we going to figure this out? You know, you go, I really hope the Spirit gives us a name and a birth date and a location so we can kind of narrow this down. And it's like, well, and you go, does it work that way? No. And I don't think it worked that way with Christ particularly either. As, you know, the choosing of the apostles came after a good number of disciples had spent quite a lot of time with Christ already. And so he knew them. and he knew their hearts. And, you know, and he could make choices based on that. We're just coming out of Santa Rosa. I said I was going to stop because I feel like I didn't have anything to say, but I do. And so, yes, I have no problem with these kinds of things. Very understandable, given, I'd say, human limitations. If a particular person really needs to, you know, from some place that you've never heard of, some little village in some tiny place, in Bolivia, they said things are going to shuffle, things are going to happen, so that for some reason they rub shoulders with the right people so that they can be noticed, so that they can be considered. It's that simple. And I'd have to say it typically happens at state presidency calls, because that's really the first time you're going to run into a 70, especially a general authority 70, is going to be when a state president gets chosen. In fact, I think they purposefully send general authority 70s to call state presidents just so they can start getting a sense for them, so it can begin, because that is going to be basically the pool of area authority 70s, of mission presidents, of temple presidents. That's basically the pool. Every once in a while, you'll get noticed by other people. You know, like my uncle Norman Nemro. He was a very liked professor at BYU, and I think that's what got him noticed. He was in a state presidency in a BYU stake, of which there are 200 or so. Well, I don't know. There are at least 200 stakes at BYU, just because of all the people, how compressed it is. And you know, he probably wouldn't have been noticed in those situations, just because he was one among hundreds. You know, he got noticed for other reasons. And he served as a mission president in Korea, and then he got called as an Area Authority 70. He got released not too long ago, maybe a year ago. And, you know, but I think it was more from his notoriety at BYU to where he got noticed. This isn't it, you know, and you go, oh, well, that's, well, everybody needs to try to get a job as a professor at BYU. And you go, Don't strive for this stuff. I said, frankly, I don't even know if these are particularly pleasant jobs. You know? Anyway, so I used to think about, boy, you know, I have a bishop folder, which I really didn't have. Or a stake president folder, you know, you say, oh, well, there's something. Well, you know, I would put that in my stake president folder. That's something good that I saw somebody do that I would do if I were the stake president. Or you'd put something in where you'd say, I don't like what they did. I would have done it this way. And I would put that in the state president folder, too. You know, it was all just kind of in my head. And I did that for a while, you know. Boy, you're going to be some kind of wonderful thing in the church. And it's like, no. It says, I have never been anything more than, well, I think I only spent like a month or two. It was almost like when I was on my mission. You know, I was a district leader once, and I think I was a district leader for all of a month before I was moved out and went back into the trenches. And you know what? I kind of like being in the trenches. I'm not a big fan of being the titular head of something. I feel like I'm pretty well respected, you know. Well, I don't know. Anymore, I feel like I'm probably becoming a thorn in people's sides. You know, I have always kind of vacillated between being an elder's quorum president and being a clerk. Right now I'm serving as the clerk, which I like just fine. I know I've spoken at times about the fact that I am a, according to the tradition and according to records, that the men in my family are literal descendants of Aaron. And, you know, I don't know how many there are. I guess there's plenty of people that have come and said, you know, well, I'm a literal descendant of Aaron, and that means I'm entitled to be the presiding bishop of the church. And apparently it's been done enough that there's been a couple of people that have even spoken on it, come back and said, do you really want to have the job of the presiding bishopric and there only being one of you? Is that really what you want? And, you know, and they would leave it at that, you know. The story went in. I don't know what the guy bringing it up said. And yeah, am I in that group? Yes. You know, my father is certainly far, you know, if it's done by seniority and you know, firstborn. My dad isn't the firstborn, but he's the firstborn living now. And he's the if our family was to be that group, and it seems interesting that my Uncle Norm has had the ear of these people, and I can't think that at some point it came out that he is also a literal descendant of Aaron. You know, he certainly got a good training in accountancy and auditing to to be a good choice for that mantle. Of course, the only problem is he's got two brothers older than he is. You know, and it's supposed to be the firstborn, which would technically be my father. And my father, although he did have businesses, you know, he never struck me as a business manager. It wasn't his forte at all. His forte was sales. He was a salesman, and he ran a company based on being the salesman that kept the company going. You know, it was his company. The next brother down, Nathan, as far as I know, Nathan kind of, I think, is more of a salesman as well. He took over grandpa's business, Nemro Sales Company. I don't know if he does it anymore. I think one of his sons now runs the company, and Nath may very well just be like, I don't know if it's set up as a corporation or whatever it's set up as. He might still have a board position, if there is such a thing in the company. Regardless, so yeah, there's beyond Norman, and I'm not, well, I'm not talking down Uncle Norm at all. He's a great guy. Love him to death. He's a fantastic guy and very successful. Probably the most successful of my grandfather's children. This monetarily made a lot of money very, very, very young. Very energetic, got the job done. Anyway, so, and I'm a second son too. My older brother Joe said, is he most likely the best candidate after my father? If all of a sudden it was decided, hey, it's the Nemros, they're gonna be presiding bishops of the church, I'm not in that hunt particularly at all. I'm, you know, although my dad would be the first in line to be considered if it was our family, my brother Joe would be the next in line for this. I find it interesting, though, that Joe's oldest son, my nephew, Joseph Allen Nemro, he's a bishop right now. And as far as I'm aware of, he is the first bishop among our group, in our family. I think he is the first bishop. And so, and it's sensible for Joseph Allen Nemro to probably be, if our family is to be the one to be the literal descendant of Aaron that actually gets set apart by the first presidency as the presiding bishop of the church. I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was Joseph Allen Nemro, which is my nephew. Good, solid kid. Not a kid. Good, solid man. And, you know, he was just a young kid. You know, I got to be careful. No, he was probably called as bishop when he was 31, 32. It just happened maybe about, I don't even know if it's been a year yet. Anyway. I'm old enough now. My oldest daughter is 30. She's 31. Oh my gosh. Pardon me. She's 31 years old. And so yeah, you know, I'm in that place. I'm 54 and she's 31, and that's, you know, everybody goes, oh my gosh, you're not that old. And I go, well, I'm 54. And they go, oh my gosh, you don't look 54. It's like, thank you. You're so nice. You know, I had a friend that was 70 that I swore was in his late 50s for just how he looked. It was surprising when he died. He died rather young. He died in his early 70s still, which was really quite surprising. I thought he would live a good long time, just based on how he looked and how he carried himself and how he seemed very active, more active than I am. Can I be honest, though? People who are really active tend to die younger. I'll probably live to a ripe old age just because I'm not taking very good care of myself particularly. Is that a scary thought? Anyway. Oh. So yeah. So you know, and that's why I say, you know, if it was going to happen, it would most likely be through the instrumentality of Norm. You know, of them coming to him and saying, "Hey, Norm, how you doing?" And you go, "Oh, hi, Elder Suarez," or whatever. You know, because they had met, they had been in councils together, you know, or whomever of the 12 to say, you know, "I hear you're a literal descendant of Aaron," and he goes, "Oh yes, we have discovered this." And it's like, well, okay, the time has come for a literal descendant of Aaron to be the presiding bishop of the church. And I came to you, and he would be the first one to say, I'm number five of five. Says I'm probably not the guy. It's, you know, people are gonna get weird if you don't, you know, if you don't give them a good excuse why I'm not the firstborn of my family. And he would point at my father, who would say, "Oh no, I don't think Dad would take that job. I don't think he thinks anything of it." And I understand that, you know. My brother Joe, whom I love dearly, we are more in common than we are not. But we are different, you know. We aren't like twins or anything. Joe has kind of gone into seclusion. I understand why in a very visceral way. And I don't blame him for going into seclusion to a certain extent. I appreciate his troubles. I always thought that he was the one that didn't have as many troubles as I did, but I was wrong. I think Joe has just as many troubles, if not a few more than I do. And it's really gotten to him, and I understand that. I'm not going to say anything bad about Joe. He's a good guy. He's a man that I respect greatly. He's a guy with his head on his shoulders, and he's just not very tolerant of other people right now. And it's understandable. He's been worked over by several people. People that should have, that you should have been able to put your trust in, you know, people of high position, even within the church, I don't know if they betrayed him or if, you know, whatever. It's a tricky circumstance. So like I said, it would probably be Joseph Allen, his son, young fella, energetic, love him to death. I think he's a great guy, and I think he'd make a great presiding bishop of the church. Now it may end up happening the old-fashioned way. He's a bishop now. He'll get called to be a counselor in the state presidency at some point. Then he might actually be called as a state president. Sometimes this takes decades. And you know, then he'll be noticed. Chances are he'll do a stint as a mission president. I'm trying to remember where he served his mission. I think it was someplace in Central America, maybe? I don't remember. But yes, he served a foreign mission, which isn't bad. And I'm not saying that that's a perk or that's good or that helps you along or it doesn't. I don't think that's a big thing, but it never hurts. He may be called as a mission president. And I think that's when these things really kind of get stirred up. Regardless, and you're going, well, that's not the way the Lord's church is supposed to run. And you go, can I be honest? How else could it run? It's like listening to leftists when they're on a utopian rant. It will always be some dirty little kid in some backwater that just gets plucked up out of the mud and becomes the ruler of the universe. And you're going, how would that ever happen? And I always think it's funny because the only way the leftist utopia that they dream of and how it could go, the only way that it could function on that level is if it was run by a god. Honestly. So when these guys say, oh, I'm not religious, I don't believe in that garbage, I don't believe in some supreme being that runs our, that has everything well in hand, I don't believe in any of that stuff. And you're going, dude, everything you wish for, everything you hope for, demands such a being. Because otherwise, you would always make the wrong decisions about who should be in charge. Who should be the planners? Who should be the executives? The lead troll of your leftist utopia. You go. They would have to be Jesus Christ, basically. Now, you could call him by a different name, but they would have to have all the attributes that a conservative evangelical Christian would attach to Jesus Christ. They'd have to have all the attributes. They would have to be able to practically see into your soul. They would have to know the end from the beginning. I'm going to choose this person because I know it through looking through their heart that they will not fail, that they will not be corrupted. And you're going, see, you guys are hilarious. You swear up and down that you don't believe in something, yet you've got to have that something to make what you want work, which you're constantly striving for. All this thing about democratic socialism, it's only democratic until it comes to power. Then the democracy goes away because of one truism. It says people are fickle. People are easily manipulated. And every time something goes like that, it leads almost immediately to corruption. Almost immediately, even if you think you've really got a good person in that place. Now, of course, every leftist wants it to be a woman because they think women would do a better job, and I'm not going to sit here and try to say whether that's true or not. So I said, oh, it can't be Jesus Christ because he was a man. And you go, fine, Jesus Christ with breasts, okay, does that make you feel better? But that's still the person you want.
You want Joan of Arc. You want Maya Angelou. You want one person with a mix of all that. And of course they say, well, we don't need that. We'll just hire all of them and tell them that they're the leader. And you're going, wow, I think you're going to see them all trying to kill each other. It says, and then your estimation of all those wonderful people will really go down to the floor, because it's like, I just can't. I said, yeah. I said, I'm sorry. It says, who's going to be the right leader? And you go, Jesus Christ. It says, it really will be. It says, well, that's a fictitious character. And you go, well, then okay. Then what you're saying is you're never going to have it. Why do you keep striving for it? Why don't you just strive to, I don't know, make enough money so you can give away a lot of clothes to the poor. That's a noble thing. Why don't you do something like that? Why are you trying to push through a socialism that will not work? At least with the people we have now. Like I've said, I still harbor, and I'm not saying it's in my heart, but I still harbor the thought that the socialist utopia is the terrestrial kingdom. Now the whole problem is that you're still going to have to acknowledge Christ. It's going to be his stuff. It's his world. Everything belongs to him. But he is going to let the people there govern themselves, because he's not going to be there much. You know, he's going to be in the celestial kingdom. He's going to be becoming Heavenly Father of his own spirit children and doing what Heavenly Father does. So he's not going to be going around trying to solve things in the terrestrial kingdom. He's going to turn that over to governance. And, you know, one of them, at least one of them, is going to be the socialist utopia. Everybody's wonderful. They all, you know, they all do the right thing. They all work very, very hard together to make the right decisions and get the right people to do the right jobs. And it's going to work because you aren't going to have Adolf Hitler there. Adolf Hitler's not going to make it there. I don't know where Adolf Hitler goes, but it can't be anything higher than the Telestial Kingdom, where things will function exactly the way they function here. You know? There's a reason why this is a terrestrial world. It's because the next terrestrial world will look a lot like this. It'll be better. It'll be better, I tell ya. But would function like this? Yes. Will there be graft and greed and corruption, things like that? And the answer is yes, there will be. Well, how could that be? And you go, because of the people that are there. It's always about the people. Anyway, so, yeah. So when people get really angry about the church and say that it's mismanaged or bad things are happening there, guess what? It's going to invariably happen. God even set it up. I mean, one of the purposes of the presiding bishop is to serve as a judge if it's found that there is apostasy. If some discipline has to be done to a member of the first presidency, probably to the Quorum of the Twelve too, that's part of what that guy, oh, you're probably going to get a lot of crap out of that. Let me hold it for a little bit. That's one of the stated functions of the presiding bishop, is that he's in charge of that kind of a proceeding if necessary. So yeah, is it going to be a perfect outfit? No. Are big people going to fall? Yes. Joseph Smith's time. It seemed like once they got to Nauvoo, to Missouri, there started being a lot of high-level excommunications. Lots of them. You know, I don't know how many people were left at Brigham Young's time of the original 12 called by, frankly, it was called by the three witnesses. They served as a temporary governing body. Anyway, so, yeah, we had, I don't know, but it wasn't very many. I can't say more than six of the original 12 were still present who hadn't already been censured. Some of them had apostatized and come back and came back into the 12, although they had lost their seniority. Some of them never came back into it. Oliver Cowdery apostatized from the church, and he was excommunicated. The second elder, the guy right there with Joseph Smith, I don't know if he was excommunicated. I think he was excommunicated. Anyway, he was rebaptized when the church was in Utah, when he was quite old. And, you know, he was just a regular member of the church. He did not have any standing. He had no calling, you know, of beyond maybe being a teacher. I don't know. You know, and how do you feel? Well, there it is. You know, what are you going to do? So, I was looking at Shana's Facebook page. Somebody calls this the egg yolk. This is when there is enough haze in the sky that you can look at the sun and it's round and orange, you know, in the mornings and later in the evening. Right now, it's got that egg yolk thing going. And that's something that Shana's been using. I'm really feeling quite heartened for Shana. I think she's starting to calm down a little. She was dropping a lot of F-bombs. As much as Facebook will tolerate something like an F-bomb, she was dropping them. Now that seems to have settled down. And, you know, I don't really know where Shane is going to settle when it comes to things. I'm hoping that she gets to the point to where she at least finds religion again. I mean, she has been somewhat public about her gripes with the LDS Church. She certainly had her name taken off the records of the church, which means that if she wants to come back, and this is what I told her when she was thinking about doing this. And I said, Shana, you know what? You know, I can't associate with a group like that. I can't associate with a group like that. And you go, Shana, every group is like that. So you're soon going to find out that even the groups that you think are pure and wonderful, like BLM or golly, who knows what else, the LGBT community that she has married herself to. You know, that you're going to find out that there's all sorts of people in there and that even the very organization itself is corrupt. They all are. They're all manipulated by forces that aren't pure at all. And you're going, you know, I says, can I be honest? I said, I think the LDS Church is better than most. Now, you know, she probably decided to walk away from the church as a result of the CES letter, something like that. Things that's like, oh no, they couldn't, yeah, they always told me the church was true. And I said, Shayna, I tried to make it a point to not say the church was true. As in, not true, but that's not the criterion. Is it the organization through which God works to accomplish his goals on earth? Yes. Does that make it perfect? No. Is it weird when a lot of people say this is a perfect organization? And it's like, no, it's not a perfect organization. Because it's filled with imperfect people. We're here at Vaughn. Oh my gosh, I've been doing this. This is probably about 2 hours in. I may run out of time. Or run out of disk space. Oh my gosh. Anyway, I usually do shorter ones, but this one just keeps going and going and going. And I'm not against that. Anyway. Makes it hard to listen to, but frankly, I'm not doing this worried too much about the people who are listening to it. It's probably not going to be listened to ever. This kind of constitutes my journal, or a journal of what I'm thinking. Everybody thinks that you're supposed to talk about your times, and you go, I don't care about my times. I'm much more worried about my about what I'm thinking. So anyway, yeah, I said, and in the case of Shayna, having really just kind of forcefully removed her name from the church, that makes it more difficult to rejoin. You know, especially if she's going to be honest about it. And that's my biggest hope. I said, be honest. Be honest. Oh, the sun is big. It's not too far above the horizon at all. It'll get a little bit bigger. But now it's getting to the point to where it's being obscured by all the haze. Which the only reason why we can see it right now is because of the fires. Anyway, that's a choice she made. It says, and the only thing is that if you ever feel like you ever want to reassociate with the church, it's a whole lot easier to just say, well, I was away for a long time, but then I started coming back. All you have to do is show up at a church building, and everybody's wonderful. I said, when you come in and they say, well, are you a member? Can we get your records? You have to say, no, I used to be a member, but I have my name removed from the records of the church. And then it becomes this larger issue. And it is. And you said, Shayna, you have never been a fan of being embarrassed. I'm not saying that there aren't many people that are okay with being embarrassed, but you particularly would do whatever it took to avoid looking bad. And you go, yeah, this just by nature looks bad. You thought that not going to church was bad optics. It's nothing like, well, I decided to go with the anti-Mormons and became one myself for a while. But now I've decided to change my mind. It says, you're going to have to talk to new people. And they're going to be looking at you funny and saying, I want to see some stuff. I want to see your willingness to do a lot of things. You aren't just going to be able to be baptized because you desire it. You know, that was the first time. You know, now it's going to have to be other things. Because a lot of blessings have to be restored. I don't know how that works. I really don't. I don't know if you have to go through the temple for the first time. Well, Shana never went through the temple. She was born in the covenant, but she never went through the temple. So there wouldn't be any of those blessings to restore. She never pursued them in the first place. She was wanting them, and that was one of the things that pissed her off, was the fact that she didn't think it was fair that boys going on missions could go to the temple when they were 18, 19, and she was older than that, and how come she couldn't have this stuff? In fact, she planned, she told everybody she was going to go on the mission, and we started getting all the stuff together to get her ready to do it, and it just fell apart. And it's like, you know, this is what? It was always kind of hard to figure Shana. And that's okay. I'm not saying that I was a clue, you know, steadfast, you know, Saturday's warrior. Look at all these wonderful warriors, you know. He flipped through the pictures of people with their eyes to the far horizon, and I know where I'm going. I've got goals. I've got, you know, and I was never that sort of guy either. So do I hold my daughter Shana up to that kind of a standard? No, I don't. You know. You know, and when she said, well, I'm going to go on a mission, and we all kind of pitched in to help her do it, start getting things going, you know, and it fell apart. I don't recall there being a lot of crap about it. You know, Shana's got a lot of me in her, and I know that would, at this particular juncture, if you said that to her, she'd probably get very angry, because she hates me right now. There is nothing about me that could ever be good. Anytime she's ever talked to me, you know, and I didn't even know this. You know, she had called home to talk to her mother, and I pick up the phone. And I said, your mom's not here, you know, she was off doing some errand. And so we started talking, and I thought we had a kind of a pleasant conversation. In fact, it had given me hope that we were past something, that we could talk together about things, and that would be okay. And then I sent her something. Oh, I sent her a video from President Nelson, that while I was listening to it, the inspiration came that I should send this to Shana. I sent it to everybody. I didn't send it just to her. But oh man, did she explode all over me. And I guess she had called home to her mother during part of this, because it was like, Shana, you just need to calm down. You need to take it easy, you know. Said your father did, you know, he does that sometimes, and you know, and I guess the subject came up about that earlier phone call, and she had said, I hated doing it, I regret doing it, it was a horrible thing, it was torturous. And it's like, what are you talking about? I thought it was pleasant. We didn't, you know, they said, you know, I pick up the phone, and I, her assistant was from your eldest, and I said, Shana, and she goes, Seamus, and I went, I'm not going there. She says, let's just keep, hi, you know, because I'm not going to play games with that. We're not playing that I changed my name game. It's garbage. I'm not doing it, you know. And she can say, well, Brenda Jelaine, you guys call her Jelaine because she wants to be called Jelaine. And you go, there was nothing behind it. I said, yours was a weird socio-political move, which I'm that's junk. I'm not going there. I'm not going there. I have no respect for it. I'm not going to go there. So, yeah, you know. And apparently I was terribly abusive to her. And I'm saying, you know what? Said I, who am I to say? Who am I to say? Everything that gets talked about that way is a he said, she said thing. So it's like, you know what? I said, fine. If you think I abused you, whatever. I said, you're 30 years old at the time, you know? I said, I don't put much stock in the fact that a few incidents of something that happened to you when you were a child will scar you for life. I said, I have absolutely no respect for that kind of stuff. I said, if that was true, this universe would have imploded 10 seconds after it started. I said, let me tell you, my mother and father's generation, what I did to you was nothing. My grandparents' generation, I would have been castigated as not disciplining my children adequately enough. So yeah, he says, I'm not, no. He says, I'm just not going there. We're not going to play the game of, I said something that didn't make you feel like $1 million and I ruined your life. No, we're not going to do that. You go, was there some physical stuff? And I'll go, as far as I recall, yes, there was. Said, did I spank you? I might have spanked you once or twice. You know, I says, well, you threw me up against the wall once or twice or three times. I says, number one, I don't remember the number. Yes, I did do that. Usually to get you to stop behaving a certain way. Usually being so self-destructive and half-suicidal just to rattle your brains and get you to start listening to other people. Because once she gets into one of those, or at least this was true in the past, I hope she's gotten better. I hope she's gotten better and that she doesn't have these kinds of thoughts. I do not condone the coddling of the suicidal tendency. I don't believe in it, because what happens is if everything stops and everybody just kind of huddles around and it's all about paying attention to you and to making sure you feel good and your wonderful needs. Oh my gosh, why is the TV coming on? Anyway, okay, it's still running good. You know, this is that just perpetuates more suicidal acting out, so that you can get people to do that, and it becomes this weird kind of you know. Well, anytime I don't get what I want, anytime I don't feel like I'm being treated the way I should be treated, I just grab for a knife or a razor blade and start cutting on myself and saying, life's not worth living anymore. And I'm sorry. You know, and they say, well, there's nothing we can do. We've got to. You know, we've got to give in to her every demand, because we're not going to let her hurt herself. And I knew some things about Shayna. One of them was she was really too frightened of pain to really go through with it. And I think statistically, that's often true. Girls talk a lot about suicide, and they will do things to try to act out to make it look like they're going to do suicide, But statistically, they're not very good at suicide. They will tend to do something stupid, like overdose, and get themselves killed that way. Now, boys who have a higher tolerance for pain sometimes, they are far more likely, if they have suicidal thoughts, to actually go through with them and commit suicide. That's why most suicides are done by guys. As far as I've read, and I don't know if I'm getting my readings from the right place, you can say all day long I don't, and that's fine. But yeah, the way I handled it with Shayna, and you can say all day long that I was wrong, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to sit there and go, you know, I'm sorry, I don't play games. And I thought that Shayna pulling the suicide card was a game. It was for attention getting. Shayna was always a person that was very much angry that she was not an only child. Lisa, you know, and you can ask Lisa, you can say, oh, Jason's just a whack. Jones, fine. Talk to my wife. And she'll tell you. I heard this mostly from her because I was off at work. I couldn't be too intimate with my children. I was around. I wasn't around, sorry. You know, I was often on jobs where I was gone for weeks. When I came home, if Lisa needed something to happen, it was mostly because she was at her wit's end and I had to step in. And, you know, I'm a boom, I get things solved. I'm not going to sit there for 5 hours and listen to Shayna say, I'm such a bad person, I can't be trusted to do anything, I can't do anything like that. No, would I throw her up against the wall to get her attention? I would. Because it would. It would bring that crap to an end. And I said, Shayna, that's garbage. You're perfectly worthwhile. Now, let's start working on what we're going to do to help you feel like you've got more worth. She conveniently will never say that to anybody. That is far more convenient for her to say, my dad was abusive. And you go, okay. Says, if you want to cast it that way, Shayna, you can. I'm not going to sit here. I'm not going to defend myself. You know, I said, if I go to jail, you can dance a jig out in front of the prison and feel like you've really done your duty, and we'll see what God thinks about it. I said, I am perfectly willing to stand before God given what I did as a father. Now, I'm not saying I did a good job. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to get castigated and punished by God for some things that I did. Frankly, I don't remember enough of them, so it's difficult to repent for specifics. I will have to be the kind of guy that said that it's like, well, Jason never was a good guy, and he did this, and he did that, and he lived up to the covenants that he made, or he learned to live up to the covenants that he made. Therefore, you know, we're going to let him into heaven. It's like, good, thank you. Well, you know, that's not how it works in the LDS church exactly, but just so you guys get the sense for it. You know, my repentance will have to be of the sort of, he changed and became a better person type of things. And it's like, well, you know, it says, Shayna, my greatest desire is that you can do the same thing. This is, but the great and nasty point is that if you're going to sit here and you're going to constantly be working over other people for things that they did decades ago or whatever, I said, you're not being very forgiving, and that's one of the things you got to be, you know. And you're going, Shayna, I don't have any, you know. Says, I think I don't think you're being very intelligent. I don't think you are I don't have much respect for some of the things that you've done. He says, but do I hate you for them? No. Do I love you? Yes. I want you to improve. I want you to do good things. I want you to be, you know, I want you to become a better person. I don't think trying to change your gender is going to do that. I don't think nitpicking about religious organizations that you don't like, I don't think that's gonna help your personal progress either. No matter what that is, I don't know what I don't know what you're shooting for. I don't know what you want in the way of your existence after this life. This is, I'm pretty sure that she is among that group. Says, and I understand this group, but it doesn't work. To have it be understood is one thing. To be able to say, well, now that you understand it, of course, it's going to, you know, we can all act like that's the way it's going to be. And it's like, no. I understand the desire that after you die, it is oblivion. There is nothing. There is nothing past this life. That way, the things that you have done here don't really have any meaning. Therefore, if you were not keeping rules, if you were hurting people, if you were a bad person, it really doesn't matter. Because it doesn't matter. You know? Because there's not any after this. But can I tell you? I'm sorry. I don't think that's so. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not so. I'm pretty sure there's somebody out there. I've had too many experiences that have helped me along that I can only attribute to a supreme being, a deity, God. Somebody who I am willing to worship as God. And, and even if I'm dealing with a bunch of atheists, which I think Shayna would style herself as, you know, it's like, you know, deciding that you're an atheist, I said, it isn't useful. You're not playing the odds very well. When you say, I'm sure there is no God, upon what do you base your certainty? Because you can't be sure there is not a God. All the days you say, well, I know you can't prove there is a God, and you're going, no, I'm not going to sit here and try to prove there's a God. It says, all I can tell you is my own personal anecdotal experience. I know that that is what you base everything on, is your own personal anecdotal experience and making sure that you feel good about how you feel about yourself, but that doesn't apply to me. I understand that. You have a different set of rules than I do. I understand. You know, is it logical? No, it's not logical. Which is what you guys depend on, is that's really what you guys want to appeal to. Well, mine's logical. And you go, no, it's not. I said, logic would say that if you're not sure of something, you should act like that something does exist, just on the off chance that it does. You know? You don't want to piss off Bill Gates just on the off chance that one day you'll run into Bill Gates and he'll hand you $1 billion. You know, why would you not leave that opportunity open? Just in case. Wouldn't that be nice? And you go, better than throwing aside the possibility completely. You know, now you can choose, you know, you can choose to say, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with God. And you go, Well, that's okay. You know, this is now, but, you know, this is, if you've read any of my stuff, you come to say, oh, wait a minute, I might have made a commitment in the past that I was going to do something, and there is punishment ahead for me for not living up to my commitment that I made before I was born, that I don't remember, which was part of the deal, was that I wouldn't remember this. And I agreed to all this. And I said, I would defend Christ. I would defend Christ's interests. I would work for him. I would follow him. And they go, yeah, well, you know, I said, how much skin is there off your nose to do it? You guys are using this logic to try to get me to wear a mask all the time. I'm going to turn around and give the same logic to you, saying, why don't you just be the good person that Christ wants you to be? What's it going to hurt? What's it going to hurt? It's such a small thing. Why don't you do it? Oh, well, no, I won't do that because that takes away from my freedom to choose. And you go, bing, 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 bing. Just like that stupid mask. I'm perfectly willing to throw myself out there knowing that I could catch COVID and die. Although, can I tell you, logic, I am not excited to use the term science much anymore, because it's much bandied about and it's misused, and its use under these circumstances is so hackneyed and terrible that I'm sorry, it gives science a bad name. Right now, I don't have a lot of respect for science, for the simple reason that I think it's more politically driven than anything else. And I'm sorry to say that I'm getting the sense that science has always been this way. It's always been politically driven. A tool used by the elite oppressor class to get their underlings to do what they're told. A very useful way to make that happen is to convince them that it's scientific and that it's, and therefore, indisputable. And you're going, okay, I'm already figuring out that this is a tool to force compliance. And I'm not a big guy on force. I don't like being forced into things. I don't like being compelled to do anything. I'm not saying you have to convince me. All I'm saying is that I don't like being compelled. I will decide to do something under my own power when the moment arrives. And I'm not going to be surprised if what they promised me, like this whole thing, if you get the vaccine, you won't have to do all this stuff and you won't have to live by all these weird draconian rules that we put together. And guess what? It doesn't matter now. Even if you got that shot, they're still pushing it. They're still pushing it as if you get the shot, you don't have to wear your mask and you don't have to social distance and you can go to your favorite bar, you can go to your favorite party or to your amusement park without any kind of restriction at all. And guess what? It's not true. You have to wear the mask. You have to social distance. And even though they're still saying, well, we're going to give you this wonderful pass if you can prove to us you've been vaccinated, now they're starting to say how you got vaccinated. You know, first they said the Johnson & Johnson one shot was good. It was just as good as anything else. Well, now it's not. And you're going, are you sure science figured this out? Or, you know, what's the other agenda running? And you keep smelling more and more of an agenda going here. You're going, well, what are you guys after? Why are you so eager to jab everybody in the arm? What's in that freaking jab that you demand that everybody get one? Everybody. Even though there's studies coming out that are saying, hey, people who had who got COVID, they've got an immunity to it now, and it's lasting a good long time. You know, and you're going, great. There's so many of us that don't need to take the immunization now. I'm pretty sure that I got COVID in January of 2020. I had all the stuff. They say, well, you were asymptomatic, and you go, no, I wasn't. I was treating it, you know, I treat it like I treat the flu. I just ignore it. And that's exactly how it went. They said, nothing to say that it wasn't the flu or wasn't COVID-19. Give me a test to tell me whether I've got the antibodies. They won't do that test. We're not even sure if that test really even exists. It's certainly not being paid for by the government. Why? Because they want you to get the jab. And you're going, what is going on? Why? Yeah. If you've had the thing, you're not going to get it, according to studies now. So, yeah, they're all talking. It's almost like every single government official either didn't get the memo or they ignored the memo and said, no, let's just get everybody. Everybody's got to get the jab. We're going to start punishing the people that won't get the jab. And you're going, I'm sorry. There's also studies out there. And this isn't really the reason why I won't do it. This is just another thing to say, well, there's some good reasons not to get the jab. It's not my reason, but it's not a bad one. Which is to say, you know, there are some studies out there that say that if you got the COVID-19 disease, if you got the virus and you overcame it, and then you got the vaccine later, it's something that there are some bad side effects to it. In fact, it's not surprising if they would actually do this study, which they won't, because they don't want to know the answer to this one, that most of the guys who are getting the vaccine and then getting COVID, supposedly, which is also kind of a farce, just because you've got bits of COVID-19 in your nasal passage doesn't mean you have the virus. It doesn't mean you have it. Regardless, let's just say for argument's sake that, yeah, you got the virus again after you got the vaccine, which they swore up and down was 99 blah 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 or 80% effective at you not getting it. Well, now they've changed their mind, and now it's like, well, it gives you a 60% chance that you won't have to be hospitalized. You know, that it's not going to kill you. It's not going to have a bad effect on you. And you're going, you know what? I said, if you guys don't know, just say, I don't know. Quit spouting things for the sole reason of trying to get people to take a jab that we're finding more and more doesn't do what was purported to be done. In fact, now there's far less reason to get a COVID vaccine than there ever has been since before we had a COVID vaccine. Okay, well, I was talking about that. It seems like if you had COVID-19 and then you get the vaccine, for some reason there's a bad interaction there. And these breakthrough incidents, which is where even a person who's been vaccinated still gets the next disease, or the COVID-19 or the Delta variant or whatever, they probably won't do the study. It probably won't be done. Certainly won't be funded. And certainly won't be accepted if it ever comes out. that those are the people that are probably getting the breakthroughs are the ones that had COVID-19 before and had the antibodies. And for some reason, whether planned or not, the vaccine interacts with whatever natural immunity comes out from the COVID-19 and apparently cancels it out or does something. We don't know what the next group of people are getting. You have to understand that. The way that COVID-19 is diagnosed is kind of a farce. I don't think there is really a particularly accurate determination of whether you have the flu or whether you have COVID-19. All they do is they give you the PCR test, which was not designed to do anything like this. And if you have bits and pieces of COVID-19 in your sinus cavity, which is easy to get if you breathe air, there's a reasonable chance that there's going to be pieces of COVID-19 in your nose. Hello? You know, it's airborne, everybody. Isn't that what everybody was fighting over for the longest time? Is this airborne? If you get near somebody, does it transmit person to person, or is it in the air? And they said, well, it's in the air. Mostly because that was the more frightening proposition, you know. And if it's true, and it might be true, it probably is. It's going to be in the air. So, yeah, if you come in with basically the symptoms of the flu and they do a test on you, and they say, well, you got little bits of COVID-19, it's going to go, bing, you got COVID-19. We don't know who's gotten it or not. We don't know. And that's what I kind of depend on. I said, I don't know. I'm sticking to my story. And until somebody does a test on me to convince me that I didn't have COVID-19 at the time, that's what I'm sticking to. Number one, I don't think they really have a test to say yay or nay about whether you've had COVID-19 particularly. Because I don't think it's that much different from the flu that it doesn't just manifest the same way as the flu does. You know, I don't care. So yeah, so when they're saying, well, are you going to get the jab? They go, no, there's no reason. Number one, growing body of evidence that the jab doesn't do anything. It doesn't prevent you from getting COVID-19. Of course, it was stupid to think that it would to begin with. You don't give people vaccines in the middle of a pandemic. It just doesn't happen. After things finally settle down, then you can start giving out vaccines based on the information you've collected. The problem is, and it's still true, I don't think COVID-19 has been positively and definitively identified in the wild. It's mostly supposition and conjecture. You say, well, you don't even believe COVID-19 exists. And I go, all I'm saying is that we don't have proof of it. I said, it just comes back to the whole thing I was saying about Shayna and about atheists. I said, you guys are acting like Christians. Do you see it? But no, they can't see it. Why did you say that? How could you possibly say that? It's so rude to say. And you're going, you're saying I need to believe in something, COVID-19, that you really have no evidence that it's there. I can explain it away two or three different ways. It might be the flu, it might be RSVs finally transferred to adults. We're treating all this weird. Why are we, Why are we doing the kinds of things we're doing? How come the therapeutics that have been shown to be good, now all of a sudden they're saying, oh no, the therapeutics are terrible, even though they've been used for other things for decades and didn't really cause anybody big problems, except for the rare few. You know, it's just, you're pitching God at me. You're pitching some kind of weird public health sectarian god of COVID-19 at me, and you're getting angry because I don't have faith that it's there and that I need to act on it. I said, I think it's hilarious because you guys... You guys won't believe, you guys refuse to believe in God, but your belief in COVID-19 and everything that Dr. Fauci, the COVID-19 prophet, tells you, and yet you come back and tell me what kind of a weird cult member I am because I believe in God and I listen to some funny guy named Russell Nelson and Thomas Monson and Gordon Hinckley and guys like that. And of course they'll just say, I don't understand what you're talking about. I don't understand where you're going with this. This is just the silliest conversation I've ever had. And you're going, it's because you guys are so blind. And I'm sorry to say, so massively ignorant that you can't see the obvious parallel there. And you're going, you know what? Nobody's giving you crap because you believe in COVID-19. You're the blessed people. You go get your shot. You go get your card that says that you are a member of the COVID-19 vaccination cult. Sorry, club. Pardon me. Oops. That was a Freudian slip, wasn't it? And, you know, and you get all kinds of special privileges, but they're not really special privileges because... You can't really use them now because you were an idiot. No, I don't want to say that. Because you were naive and a sucker. I don't want to say that either. Because you put too much faith in people who just like people used to say about the Mormon prophets, they're taking all your tithing money and they're living high on the hog on it, and you're a fool. And you're saying, you know what? You guys took their shot. You don't even know what was in it. Nobody knows what's in it. I said, and they gave you a card and a cookie, maybe some orange juice, patted you on the head, told you that you were a good little drone, and then you found out that they snookered you. They snookered you. I don't know what they gave you. I don't know what's in there, but it has, but it didn't do a darn thing about making sure you didn't get COVID-19. The chances of you getting COVID-19 now are probably almost identical to the chances of you getting COVID-19 before you got the shot and before the shot was even available. Ta-da! And you call me a cult member. Wow. Sorry, you know, I'm not saying that I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, but it just came to mind and it was really logical. And it's like, I'm not going to say logical. I apologize for using that term. It seems just as sensible as the things you say to me about my idiocy, is that I'm coming around saying, you know what, you're just as dumb as I am. You're just as naive, you're just as overly, your blind faith is just as apparent as my blind faith is. So, hey man, we're all in this together. Here I come back with good old Harry Tuttle from Brazil. We're all in this together. I thought it was funny that he was doing it when he was pumping those suits full of shit. I thought that was funny. Because it is. And when he says, we're all in this together, and then he goes, boom! And it's like, yep, you're all in shit together. So don't get weird about it, man. Don't get weird about it. Brazil! Oh, Brazil! Anyway, so I guess that's all I really have to say for now. It's gone way long. Longer one than you would want to do. Yeah, said I'm sorry. Just as much as my former daughter doesn't want to have anything to do with that weird Mormon cult, I don't want to have anything to do with that weird COVID-19 cult. I don't care how much they keep telling me I need to take the jab when every day more comes out that says that taking the jab wasn't a good thing to do. And I'm not going to sit here and say, see, told you so, because I didn't know for sure. I was going by what I would consider to be a secular version of the Holy Spirit that whispered to me, stay away from that stuff. Don't have anything to do with it. Plenty of people did. For whatever reason they did it. You know, it would have been far easier for me just take the jab and sit there and put up with it. It would have been far easier. But I'm not gonna. Because something told me not to, and I have more faith in that something than I have in all those people giving me their assurances that everything's wonderful. I'm not headed there. I'm not gonna do it. You know? And in doing that, don't we have something in common? My sanctimonious atheist friend? My dear Shayna, who is taking great pains to make sure that I am the terrible villain and she is the horrible oppressed victim. I'm sorry, horribly oppressed. She's not horrible. I'm horrible. Everybody knows that. And I'll stand by my version of Jesus Christ, who is going to come and do some damage. And you don't want to be under his scrutiny. You don't want him to come and notice you particularly, because it's not going to be nice. It's going to be nasty. And you'll likely die. And then you'll say, oh my gosh, I wish I wouldn't have died, because now I get to actually start paying for stuff that I did. You will wish you were still alive. Where me, it's like, you know, death doesn't bother me so much. It probably should, but it's just not worrying me. And I guess that's what they say about Jesus Christ. You know, I said, oh, he doesn't worry me, because I don't think he exists. And you go, okay. Says, you can think that all you want to, but it's not going to stop what may happen. Like I said, you know, are you willing to play the odds? And they say, well, of course I am. You go, okay. I says, that's all I'm saying. Are you willing to play the odds that thousands and thousands of years of people and priests and teachers and religious folk were all a bunch of deluded dupes, and that this concept that you have now that has really only been somewhat formed over the last 100 years or so, that you're pretty sure that you guys are just smarter than the last 3,000 years of humanity. He said, that's some gutsy risk taking. Says, you know, says, it's all, you know, in kind of a sick way, you almost have to kind of have a little bit of grudging respect for somebody who's so sure of themselves with so little backup to what they're putting all their cards behind. You know, I wish I had that little thing that Andy McDowell said to Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, you know, about the whole thing of, you know, he was sitting there smoking and just eating everything in the diner, throwing caution to the wind. I forget what she said, but it was the perfect thing to say in this thing, is to say, okay, just throwing the chant, that none of this is going to end up affecting you. And, you know, his was based on logic. It was true. Since he was repeating days, he could do anything he wanted that day, and it wouldn't have any effect. He would wake up at 6 o'clock the next morning. It was kind of fun for a while. The wild abandon. And it's like, well, you can play like you can do the wild abandon thing. Take your chances. And hope to heck there is no tomorrow. That's exactly what's going on. Is I am betting on the fact that there's not going to be a tomorrow. And that anything I do here just really doesn't matter. And so why not have fun? Why not rip off liquor stores? Why not, you know, why worry about being a decent person? Why worry about keeping basic commandments? Why worry about any of that if there's no tomorrow? Ta-da. And then they'll, you know, there's scripture about that. Wow, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And the real hope is that when you die, it's an oblivion, and that you just cease to exist. And then you can say, yeah, it doesn't matter. I could do whatever I wanted. And you go, it's true. Isn't it a very effective test to see what kind of a person you are? And even just looking at it that way, it's, dare I say, almost diabolical in saying, wow, what a great way to figure out what kind of a person you are. If everybody, you know, if people have no idea if God really exists, if people don't have, you know, if even though you give them commandments, and most of them, no, I dare say all of them, are very sensible, you know. You don't have to worry about a lot of things if you're keeping God's commandments. Now there's the whole group of people who say, well, I feel so constrained. I don't feel free. I just feel like it's a straitjacket on me. And you go, yeah, okay. And you go, well, then fine. Act like there's not. See what happens. I go, but, you know, I'm entitled by God to warn you about what's going to happen. It's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be nice at all. It's going to be nasty. It's called hell. You're going to go there and you're going to be punished for everything that you do that you don't repent of, which means change and become a better person. Number one, stop sinning, or stop that sin one at a time. You know, it doesn't have to be done all in a second, by golly. You work on one thing at a time, you grow, you progress, you do better. The funny thing is, if you keep the commandments that God gives you, it actually makes you a better person. And then the chances of you being happier are excellent. Now, that doesn't, you know, I don't know how much I get the happy feeling, but it doesn't matter. For most people, that's how it works. you know, and do it, you know. Even though I don't get those happy feelings of feeling like that I'm not in trouble all the time, you know, I don't feel those, I guess, very strongly, or I don't trust in them very much, but I still do it because I have faith, a reasonable faith, that in doing these things, things will go better for me. And you can say, well, that's silly God talk, and you go, I don't care. So the whole point is, I think it works. And you go, now, you know, you can swear all up and down, you don't have to do that, and you're going to have lots of fun, and you're going to get drunk, and you're going to, you know, you're going to have weird health problems because of the weird drugs that you chose to take, to do this, 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 and this, to fit in with some group, to feel like you were a part of something. Especially nice if that group has absolutely no standards whatsoever, except compliance with the demands of the group. That's going to be the funniest part, is if you get a smart idea, if you have a certain thing and you happen to say something about it, and all of a sudden you find out, oh my gosh, this was something that other people, like the LGBT community, which is hilarious, it's not a community, it's a bunch of people that work together politically because there are some things they would like to have happen. The gays work with the transgenders because they both want all those rules about conduct to go away. They don't want them to go away for the same reasons. And they may not care when it ultimately comes down to it. If the gays ultimately get the majority of what they want, they probably won't be very hip to keep helping transgenders, especially if they start finding out that the transgender agenda kind of runs counter to the gay agenda. It's hard to be a gay person when people are trying to tear down the distinctions between the sexes. For all you know, as a gay person, you're getting the hots for a woman who just has done a good job of making themselves look like the man of your dreams. And then what are you going to do? It says, well, I thought we were going to have the kind of sex and relationship that gay guys have, but all of a sudden, I'm presented with this weird vagina. What am I supposed to do with that? And you go, yeah, isn't that confusing? Now, all of a sudden, you're not gay. I don't know what you are anymore. You know, because it's not two penises there. It's a penis and a vagina. And you're going, oh my gosh, we're almost natural. And you go, And your gay brothers and sisters will be coming back and giving you crap because you're not properly participating in the baptism of gayness, which is engaging in same-sex sex. Having those kinds of things going on. You know, and you're going, wait a minute, I'm so confused, and now I'm losing my affinity group because I'm not doing what they're doing, which is the whole thing. That's the whole thing about the affinity group, is you have to do what we're doing. You have to make us feel good about what we're doing. And you're going, it seems kind of compatible now. It really isn't. You guys are just working together because you both think you're oppressed. And guess what? The oppression level's really going down. And when that starts happening, you don't know what to do, because it was all about us coming together and crying on each other's shoulders for how rude everybody treats us and how mean everybody is and how unsympathetic they are to our plight. And it's like, well, guess what? Now you really don't have a plight. You can do whatever you want. We don't care. But we're not giving you anything special. The blacks are killing themselves trying to keep themselves oppressed. And guess what? That sucks after a while, since I'm tired of being oppressed. I just want to move on. But the other blacks are sitting there saying, dude, if you try to move on, we're going to make your life a living hell. Ask Larry Elder. Ask black people who have found success. And, you know, there is the only acceptable success for the black oppressive group is that if you make good money being black, if you transcend that, you're in trouble and you're going to be under attack. And you're going to find pretty soon that all this brother and sisterly love among black people is so much garbage. And you'll find yourself with new groups of people that don't really care what color your skin is. You'll find yourself among people who have gotten successful as you have. And that you have more in common with them than with people that have your same skin color, particularly. And that happens to every oppressive group, but it has to happen individually. If you continue to hang your hat on your blackness, it'll never become anything except that you'll be an activist that's actually feeding like some weird vampire on the very people that you call your brothers and your sisters. You become vampiric. And the sad part is, that's already true with gay and lesbian sort of people. Those groups, if you subscribe to the community, you already start figuring out that there's vampires among you. People that if you decide that being gay isn't working out for you, you tried it and it's not very good, there's going to be a big backlash when you start saying, you know what, I don't feel like I'm gay anymore. Ask Milo Yiannopoulos. He's not to the point to where he says he's not gay anymore, but he's to the point where he says, I'm not out there being flaming anymore. I'm not, you know, I've decided that I'm not going to engage in the lifestyle. I am going to attempt to be celibate in relation to that. And I hope he gets to the point to where he says, you know what, being celibate sucks. I would like to have sex, and because I have in the past, and it's tough, you know, it's tough to overcome, because it's built into you. It's built into you to want to have sex. And, you know, maybe you'll find a girl, and all of a sudden you'll find out, oh my gosh. Now that's probably not true, because most gay men, most lesbian women, whatever, they have tried a lot of things, and they have tried sex with a lot of different people of both sexes, of whatever persuasion you wish. And they decide they liked, you know, same sex better. However, yeah, you know, the whole exploratory phase. And you're going, well, yeah, hello. Most people who decide that they're gay have done it because they've tried it out. And they've decided they prefer one over the other. I get on, I'm not, sorry. Golly, I needed to stop this thing. Okay, I'm going to stop it. It's easy. Turn off a switch, it's over.
All right. Let's do it. Have a great day.